You are listening to Upvester podcast, which is about people who have decided to not settle for less and have committed to take responsibility of their lives and successes. Upvester is a person with a growth mindset who is entrepreneurial, determined, inspiration to many, and is true to themselves.
Hello, hello. We have another podcast coming at you, and today we have Kart Pormeriste with us, who, as she herself says, is a freelance lawyer with a PhD. But I'll let her introduce herself a little bit further before we go into the topic of today, which is...
Anna. Well, how to survive your PhD.
So, Kart, what do you have to say about your introduction?
Hello, hello. So, I am a freelance lawyer, as I like to put it, because otherwise I'd have to say I'm a YouTuber, which I hate because it sounds lame. But what I do is I try to create content on YouTube on topics regarding the law. And mostly my aim is to inform the general public of some aspects of the law or just give commentary on some cases and so on. So I am a YouTuber, but that doesn't sound good. So I'm a freelance lawyer in my email signature. And I have a PhD, which I just mentioned because I put work into getting one, though I'm not explicitly using it right now.
What do you mean? What do you mean? I think you are using it on a daily basis. And this is also one of the discussions we had quite recently. I was telling Ilona about with Kart that what is a high level of mastery in certain field? And I analyzed actually the sort of path to high level mastery in the legal field, and the sort of the extreme or the unique end result of it is that you use the knowledge and the mastery you have acquired in this field in the way that you want, and it might be innovative like Kart is doing, and we had quite recently this discussion with Kart actually, that whether doing this on YouTube is exploiting your knowledge.
Right. Well, you are correct. I guess I was, when I said I'm not using my PhD, it's more in the formal sense that where could one use a PhD is academia, obviously, right? You could become a professor with a PhD and that's where it's a requirement, whereas a PhD is not a requirement to be on YouTube or wherever. But you are very right, because what is a PhD or what skills do you actually develop is skills of research. Independent research is actually the skill that you are honing during the PhD studies. And that is what is allowing me to do this social media thing, because all the topics that I address are different. I go from one topic to another. And the only way I can do that is by researching them independently, though I cannot go in depth because I don't have the time or the resources for it, but just the basic ability to conduct legal research on any topic independently. So you are right that I'm actually using the skills,
exactly,
not the title per se, though it does sound fancy.
But I think we have actually two different topics here. One is what has PhD given us, as in the path to mastery, which Anne suggested, and the other one is credibility. Because even when you're scrolling on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube and you come across somebody who puts, you know, comma PhD after themselves, then it's instant credibility. It's, you know, you're creating authority bias, as in I'm believable because I have a higher degree. And then we get back to the issue of what has it given us. You said, Kart, that it's essentially how to do research. Yeah. With me, I often joke with my students that PhD equals permanent head damage for me, because it has taught me how to think differently.
The abbreviation works.
The abbreviation works, yeah, because for me, those 3.5 years that I did my PhD, I had to research a ton of information, as you said, Kart, but at the same time, it taught me to approach things differently, taught me to see things differently, taught me to see patterns. And after that, your thinking is permanently changed.
And I just, for those listening to us and don't know, all of us, all three of us have PhDs in law. And like what motivated us to get it might not be what we're using it for.
True, motivations are different, and also what we got out of it is quite different.
And because Eliana mentioned that she did her PhD in 3.5 years, I just want to say that I was the longest running PhD candidate in the room. And in our program, in the program that I actually did the same program at GATT, IT Law PhD in Tartu University. And Ilona, you did your PhD where?
I did mine in Cambridge, UK, and it was more an interdisciplinary one, as in that's why my thinking is permanently changed. I took law, economics, social sciences, and psychology, and try to come up with new principles that the judges can use to throw cases out of courts.
What was the title of your thesis?
Don't ask me that. That's a real unfair question after like 15 years. But it was literally the principles that judges can use to impose ADHR on parties in commercial cases that are essentially about money. But that was the essence of it.
Sounds really interesting.
And I did come up with new principles. As things stand, I think they are actually applied by Estonian courts. But now it's also on the level of the law that the judges are supposed to look at cases which are purely monetary and suggest to parties that, would you like to go and consider a compromise, please, and then come back after you've done that. So that's essentially what the UK courts did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And that's where I got the idea, because I read an interesting article and it kind of took from there.
Right. But just, I got stuck thinking about your earlier comment about, you know, adding the title PhD to your social media credentials or whatever. I actually haven't done that on YouTube, and I usually don't mention it. I only mentioned it on one or maybe a couple occasions, but one of them was where I was opposing this guy who doesn't have a PhD. So I was just jokingly saying, by the way, I have one, so trust my argument more. That was more in a joking manner. But the thing is, why I haven't put it there is because sometimes these credentials can, I guess, be a little bit off-putting for other people, for laymen. So if I'm trying to approach the average person, trying to make law easy and fun, I sometimes think that the title PhD might make me sound too far removed from real life, perhaps, or too serious. I don't know how it actually comes across, but I've been hesitant to put it anywhere close to my social media channels in that form.
I know LinkedIn isn't a social media channel, but I think...
Yes, it is. Now it is.
Okay, now
sure.
It's fine. Yes, because there's posts and
she
stuff.
She has it on LinkedIn.
Actually. I have it on LinkedIn.
I
but
have it on LinkedIn
but it's
well.
More professional. So that's... I'm not sharing my content on LinkedIn. That's why LinkedIn is an exception. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, the title might be a bit...
I think we're getting into another topic, which we need to discuss separately, which is not professional pride, because that you have, but the imposter syndrome. Not as in sure. Not using all of the credentials that you have so that you think that you might be perceived in a certain way. But I think that that's actually rubbish, because that might be off-putting to people who don't know you, but the people who already know you, who have listened to at least one podcast, one YouTube short or reel or whatever, they already know how personable you are. They already know how you can explain things. They already know that you mean business. And then it's not a deterrent. And if it is a deterrent to some people not to actually listen to you, whether they think that it's fake, whether they think that, you know, you are trying to sound more serious than you are, then it's like, if you don't listen to at least one thing, then you will never know. And once they do, then it's no longer a deterrent. So dare to do that. Dare to put the PhD in your social media, please.
I mean, I cannot argue with anything you said, but I don't think my reason for not using the title on YouTube, which is my main and only channel at this point, I don't think it has to do with imposter syndrome. That's not the issue. I want the first impression to be fun and light. And my approach is the contrary to what you described. It's not about people first seeing, oh, PhD, and then listening and maybe realizing, oh, this is not that serious. It's more of a fun tone. But more on the other hand, that I'll start with fun. I try to reel them in with the non-serious, with the fun, the stupid. And then I go along and become more serious with the talk to sort of lure people into listening to legal stuff without perhaps necessarily realizing at the get-go that it's going to be legal.
I just wanted to give you this feedback that if, or reflection actually, that if you reveal that you have the PhD, like one assumption that we have, if a person knows the topic really well, they should be able to say it the simplest way possible because they really get it. They are able to explain something really difficult in a very simple way. So that's the PhD kind of also. But the second thing is that you should also think of all the misconceptions and the prejudice that is against people with PhD and just like shatter it or you know, break it. Because we are normal people. We know how to have fun. Well, normal in this sense that we know how to explain things simply and how to sort of talk to, like Kat was saying,
right, that layman. A PhD doesn't have to be the serious professor guy, super complex sentences and
non-approachable,
so on. Yeah.
And like totally like non-communicative or non-interactive. Like PhD can also be that you actually are able, like Kat is doing, to explain something that is difficult in a very simple form. And explaining this in a content that is provided in YouTube in these short videos is, I think, perfection. This is mastery. This is actually using your PhD in certain field in the targeted way that it is supposed to be used.
For the greater good. And I actually like your explanation, Kat, that you said that you reel them in. You're using out of the three social media postulates, entertain, educate, inspire. You're using the first two. And you're using them exactly in that order, entertain and then educate. Whereas the one that I suggested was the other way around, as an educate and then, by the way, entertain. So yeah, there's different approaches. But I do agree with you, Anna, that to explain very complex things in a very simple way, it takes mastery. It takes skill. It takes years to learn, actually. And it's not only the PhD, it also has to do with the way that you generally yourself are.
Oh, absolutely. Because I've learned that one of the most important things to be able to put yourself out there on a social media platform and try to communicate your specialty or area of expertise to everybody else is just letting go of your ego somewhat and just letting go of the fear of being perceived as whatever negative things you will eventually inevitably be perceived as if you put yourself out there. So
well, whatever positive things that you are perceived
for
as,
sure, of
as
course.
In some people might put you on a pedestal and then if you do a silly video, then they're like, well, that's not what being a lawyer is supposed to be about or whatnot, but it can be that.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to have that issue because I use a lot of colorful language in most of my videos for the specific purpose that I don't want this expectation to be of a serious lawyer, serious legal talk. It's still, the aim is to create a context of creating a feeling as if you're talking almost to a friend or just talking to anybody about the topic and not to have this lectury vibe sort of to the videos. But it doesn't always turn out that way, but that's what I'm aiming for. And that does take sort of, and it took time. It's not like it was easy from the get-go. If I look back at the first videos, I had almost cramps in my face. Like half of my face was like paralyzed or my mouth would make these nervous movements because it's scary. It's not as it's that easy because, you know, the world is not so nice always. Sure, there's positive feedback as well, but you can be assured no matter what you do or what you say, or if you try, if your sole purpose is to give useful information, there will still be somebody who says, this is stupid. Yeah, this is stupid. You are pointless. Like, stop breathing, basically. But maybe coming back to the PhD topic, I just want to emphasize one thing that although all three of us have PhDs, I think Ilona's experience at Cambridge, was it? Right. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what Anna and I went through because the experience that we have, and this is with all love and due respect to our alma mater, to Tartu University. I gotten 3 degrees there. I have utmost respect for all of my supervisors and so on. Now, with that disclaimer being said, the PhD program was, well, let's start with this. My topic was about data protection and specifically in research, human genetic research. At the time, this was 2016, I think, when we applied for it, or was it 15, something around that. And there was no person at our university specifically dealing with data protection. This was 2016. The GDPR was already done, finished, right? It would come into force 2 years later. Mm-hmm. But data protection was already on the rise as a hot topic. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a single professor who was focusing on that topic. So that was already a struggling point. That is something you would never, like, that wouldn't happen at Cambridge. I guess if you study law there, you would have a possible supervisor for basically any given topic, I would assume. We didn't
assumptions.
It's true. I do have an assumption of excellence for universities like Cambridge, but that was the starting point. And then my experience was this. The reason I went into PhD studies in the first place was boredom. I was bored at my job. I was a lawyer at the State Agency of Medicines and a lawyer at the Department of Inspectorates. These are the people that give licenses to pharmacies and pharmaceutical wholesalers, mm-hmm. and then inspect them to make sure everything is up to code. And that was incredibly boring. There wasn't any sort of excitement to it. I needed some sort of something in my life. So I said, PhD. I applied. And after we had submitted the documents, a professor whom I somewhat knew, not personally, but we had come into contact before, I'd taken some of his classes, he called me and he said, you know what? Oh, when I applied, I didn't have a supervisor yet, right? I applied without having a supervisor, hoping I would find one after I hopefully get in. He called and he said, you know what? Your proposal is shit. You need to redo it. You need to find a supervisor. Come again in the fall. I was, okay, well, thanks. He didn't mean it in a bad way. He's
very direct.
He's very direct. I love that. So that wasn't the issue. I was like, oh, cool, thanks. I'll try again. No problem. But then everybody already had interview times. So everybody was supposed to have interviews as well. And I was like, well, if I already have the spot, I might as well go to the interview. And I went to the interview and it went so. I mean, they were all doubting my topic. They were like, what do you mean, like, data protection and human genetic research? Like, this famous lawyer, Hans Nümper, already wrote a thesis like 15 years ago. What is there more to write about this same topic? I'm like, well, data protection law has sort of evolved, right? A little bit, mm-hmm. these 15 years, and it's just getting more and more. It's more and more on the rise. And I just came away from that interview thinking, well, whatever, I tried. And then I got in. I got into the program. Although I was told, you're not getting in. So somebody was really bad at the interview stage. And that was the first what the hell moment, because I could have just not gone to the interview after that phone call, but I did anyhow. And then I got in. I was like, all right, then. Great. Now I'm in. And I asked one of the civil law professors, who I also had previous experiences with, I asked her to supervise me because I knew she was in my view, a cool person that wouldn't like put strings on me. I could do basically my research on my own, but the university required us to have one IT professor, I think. So I got one more. Then I wanted to do a comparative topic comparing the EU and America. So they wanted me to have a US supervisor. So I got one. I spent a year with Fulbright doing a health law LLM in Texas. So I got one of my professors from that time. And then for some reason, I was forced to have a fourth supervisor. And I don't even remember. No, wait, is that four?
Yeah, that's four. Like one from the department, law department, right?
Law, IT, the American professor. Guys, I need to literally Google, did I have a fourth one? Because I remember there being an issue with it. I just don't remember.
But if we're comparing the entrance and the process, then let's compare. Because I feel that our paths to the PhD and mastery are very different. Anna, what about you? What was your cause for entering the PhD program and how did your entrance go?
I think the very sort of the push came from the head of the IT Law Masters program. At the time, it was Helen Enma. She had an additional last name in the meanwhile, but she said that, don't you want to apply? Because I was doing the IT Law Masters program.
So you were offered?
I was sort of asked whether I would like to submit a proposal. I had two ideas. One was about blockchain technology and regulation, and the other one actually was about lawyers using IT and sort of technology influencing the life of a lawyer and legal services. And she kind of nudged me towards this blockchain, and because Bitcoin was really hot at that time. And it was actually 6 months later than Gert applied. Gert was sort of the first wave, and I came in the second wave. And I can similarly say that when I submitted my proposal, nobody actually called me, but I did not actually receive enough points to get in even after the interview. So somebody got in and refused the spot, and then the spot became open and I got in.
And now we're sitting here having this discussion almost 10 years later.
Almost.
It's weird, right? So I need to apologize to my fourth supervisor. I forgot I had one who's a professor of clinical genetics. She was super nice and helpful, and I hate myself for having forgotten. But there was a big fuss about, you know, who had to be the supervisor. I was supposed to have Helen as well at some point. There was some drama, I remember. I don't remember the details. In the end, I had four supervisors, but none of them had any expertise in EU data protection law. And that was my topic. So I was still out on my own. And now this is where it gets stupid, in my opinion, what we experienced together. I don't know how Anna remembers this, but I think it was the second semester of the first year. For me, it was then the third semester, right? I started, I think, in winter or the beginning of the year. You joined the program in the fall, and then the beginning of the next year. So I was in a year and a half already. We had this sort of course. It wasn't actually a course other than a bunch of PhD students presenting their idea for the thesis. So there was half the room was filled with professors or lecturers, the other half with PhD students, like 10 and 10, something like that. And we had to also introduce methodology. And methodology is a funny thing in law, because I had studied at that university for 5 years, and apparently that wasn't enough to learn methodology. Neither was it for the rest of us, because a lot of us mentioned using this comparative historic research method, which to me was, well, we have this new GDPR, then there used to be this directive in 1995. So this is sort of historic, right? You're comparing different historic stages of data protection law. And a lot of other students mentioned this as well for similar reasons. And then some of the lecturers, I'll just say professor because it's easier, they're not all professors, but they were mocking us like, this is not historic comparative. They were literally mocking us about it. And then one of them, who's, God bless him, I think a little autistic, which is great because he's super direct, he's like, just like slammed his hand almost on the tables, asking, looking at the professors, other professors asking, okay, guys, what is this historic comparative method? Please define it. He was asking his fellow professors. Mm-hmm. Everybody was silent. Nobody has an answer. This is after they mocked the PhD students for inaccurately claiming to use this method. Finally, one of the historians, legal historians, says, well, actually, comparative historic is if you use materials pre-World War II. If you use materials before World War II and compare them to something current, then that is historic comparative. And all of us sitting there like, what the hell? I've studied here for 5 years. Nobody's ever taught me this. It's not in the student research manual, nowhere. And now you bring this explanation. And then later, one of the other professors says, this is outside of the class already, right? Sometime later says, well, that's not actually accurate either. Mm. That's not like a formal definition. So imagine this is a PhD program. You have professors making fun of students for claiming they use the historic comparative method.
And they don't know.
They don't even know what it is. It was this moment in time is just sits in my head as one of the biggest what the hell moments of my adulthood. Because how is this possible? And these experiences in the PhD program just solidified to me that nobody has any clue what they're doing. Nobody has any clue. And this happened later as well. I think maybe even the same semester, I had a manuscript accepted by, this is Oxford University Press International Data Privacy Law Journal, a really highly rated journal. They had accepted my manuscript, though with subject to amendments. And this first
editorials.
Right, yeah. Right. We had blind peer review, and the reviewer, like, it was 3 or 4 pages. And I'm so grateful for that person, because reviewers don't get paid. I've done plenty of reviews myself. And there was so much work put into that review. And we did like 3 rounds back and forth, back and forth. And I had this confirmation. And so we have another course. Most of these PhD courses were about you introducing your work or part of it. So really, really lazy ways for professors to get credits done, so that they've given classes of like 9 credits, whereas the whole class is like 4 PhDs just presenting their work. Great, right? I go to that class. I present my paper, which has been accepted by this super highly rated journal. And so a few of the professors, none of them, again, none of them data protection law professors, right? One was a historian, all of them super nice. Disclaimer here, I have a lot of respect for them, but this instance was just stupid again. Another PhD student is a very, not very famous, but sort of famous former prosecutor, criminal law guy. My topic is about data protection. If you've ever come across criminal law people, you'll know that they don't really care that much about data protection. A lot of criminal law people will be saying that if you have nothing to hide, like, why would you care about what's being done with your data, right? If nobody's doing anything bad with it, why does it matter? So my point, the point of my manuscript or the article was about people having control over their personal data and how that is used in genetic research, and whether we get information on how our data is being used. And this prosecutor, like, everybody gets to give feedback, right? All of the students, all of the professors give feedback to the presenter. And this prosecutor guy completely shoots down my topics, essentially saying it's pointless. Why would anybody care how your data is being used in research, as long as it's research? Because research is good. So data use is good in research. So why would you care? Why would it be important that you even have any sort of control over your data or anything?
It's the arguments of transparency and greater good versus civil rights.
Right. To him, it was a non-existent problem that I was addressing. And because he was, at least in the legal community, a somewhat known name, a former prosecutor, I think even state prosecutor, possibly, I think it was. So the professors, 2 or 3 of them, seemed to be sort of, you know, really in awe of him, or very, they obviously had a lot of respect for him compared to your random average PhD student. So they went along with his comments, sort of. One of them just nodded and the other one verbally like agreed and so and so. And I was sitting there.
Peer pressure and groupthink, huh?
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe, whatever it was, I was sitting there knowing that this has been accepted by the International Data Privacy Law Journal. I don't even remember if I said it. Definitely not before presenting. I hope I told them after this round of shooting it down by them. I hope I did. I have no recollection. But the feeling of knowing that they are wrong and this is a good topic, it's the same thing as in the interview round where they were asking, well, this topic has been written about so much, like consent in genetic research and data use in genetic research. 15 years ago, somebody wrote about it. And I'm trying to explain to them, right, that this is current. This is actually current. And the same thing happens in this class as well that I now described, that my topic is being shot down again and again. But by that point, I had this journal acceptance,
confidence,
knowing that I'm not imagining the importance of this topic. This is relevant. And then in the next years to come, this became more and more and more relevant. And the feeling of thinking, what if I had listened to these people? What if in the interview I would have thought like, oh, well, maybe this is a bad topic, move on. Or what if I had listen to that guy in that class? What if I didn't apply to the journals? You know, they will tell you to make your paper perfect before you submit. I don't have the patience for that. I make it as good as I know I can. I will submit it. And sometimes the answer is no, whatever. I'll try to make it a bit better. If they give any sort of feedback, I'll send to the next place. And once you get that reviewer's feedback, then you know that it's worth somebody's time. Because if the paper is complete shit, the reviewer will not put that much time into it. But if you get 3 pages of comments, that is not a sign of you did a bad job. That is a sign you did a good job, but you can do a great job. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the most important lessons to me, because the first reaction, human reaction, might be that sort of like, oh, well, I got so many comments, everything is shit in my paper. But the reality is the reviewer would never put that much effort into it if it was an actual shit paper. Mm-hmm. And every comment he gives you or she, you decide whether to implement it or not. So you need to like step out of your own personhood, sort of leave your ego behind and just look at the comments, look at the paper, be as objective as possible and try to make it better. And that was such an important life lesson that goes beyond law and beyond academia or PhD or whatever.
And it actually, like, the experience built your confidence, self-confidence, that you have to believe in yourself. And I think in PhD level, in whatever university, like Ilona was also saying, even in Cambridge, it might be that you are the most eminent expert in this field by the time you graduate. There might not be people who know this topic better because it's a topic that just recently appeared, or it's some sort of interdisciplinary field that has never been researched before.
Or because you are the only one who has researched everything that's ever been written on it.
Or you go so deep that nobody else has done it. And I think with PhD level studies, you have often this case that you don't have anybody who has done research in this particular field. And this is why they accept you. Because there hasn't been any research in this particular field, or this area has, as Gert was saying, expanded, grown. There are new legal acts out there or regulations, and you need to sort of do this again from a different angle or etc. But what I wanted to say about the program that Gert and me did was that its focus was IT law. And there, as Gert was saying, was a requirement that you had to get a supervisor from the IT department, which means that somebody who had no idea and had done no research and no experience with lawyers and legal department. And this was, I think, the most, I would say, uncomfortable experience in my PhD. And coming back to the first seminar experience that Gert was explaining, I was also there. And I remember this, I've been telling this joke to many people over the years, that one comment that one of the professors in that seminar gave, again, as a mocking feedback to a PhD candidate, was to somebody who was writing on cloud computing. And as soon as she said, the PhD candidate said, cloud computing is the topic, then the professor who was in the area of environmental law said that it must be my topic because it's related to clouds, its environment. And it was meant as a mocking joke. But at the same time, it also showed that in the room, there was no professor who actually had competence in IT law at that point. Then later on, during the program's run, there were actually 2 professors hired who were in IT law, or so associate professors, but we said that we call them all professors, who had some sort of relevance to IT law. So when we started and when this program was started, there was actually nobody who even understood like the technology part there. And I found the most difficult part in this was sort of including the description of the technology into your thesis and sort of getting this approved by the professors in the law school. It was definitely approved by the journals because they knew you have to first sort of try to explain where you land, what is your context, and then, you know, approach the law part in that. But once I started writing, you had to do these elaborate descriptions of what the technology builds as a challenge. Like, what is the sort of the area where you're applying the law in and why the technology poses a challenge for the application of law. And that was somewhat sort of not accepted by the law professors, although the IT supervisor was very keen on this being very precise and this being like lengthy and, you know, that you had to be very correct in the words that you were using. And this was a challenge for me as a lawyer as well, because I didn't know the words. You know, you were using the words that were in the articles that you were writing and that necessarily weren't the articles that an IT professor was reading. So the terminology there was also different. This actually reminded me of when I started my legal career. I worked in KPMG, one of the big four companies, and we had like corporate finance people, auditors, accountants, business consultants, legal people, then tax people. And all of us, when we were writing due diligence reports, we had to agree on terminology, which was like, oh my God. We didn't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. And now writing the PhD with your IT professor, your law professor, and get having some other professors from other jurisdictions, from common law countries, that must have been like, you know, trying to please four different mothers of four different families with how you behave in class or in home or how you clean your room, who have very different sort of value systems. So it was sort of like... what did you say the PhD standard for?
Permanent head damage.
Yes, getting a head damage and being willing to get it.
Yeah, like because you applied. But if I jump in, then what I can see is three very distinct things. One, I'll start from the end, is the quality of the people that are the ones who are supervising us, right? And there I see very distinct differences between my path and yours, because while you were being mocked by people who had very little knowledge of the things that you were trying to innovate, because it is innovation when you're trying to write something new, because nobody has ever written a PhD about something which is already known. PhD is new knowledge. And my path was, I was actually being guided. As in, I had one supervisor, one, who was not in the field that I was writing. His field was actually private international law, which was the LLM that I got. And he suggested to me that, would you like to apply? And I said no. And 4 years later, I was back in Cambridge doing a PhD. So I see similarities. That's my second point. I see similarities in the process. We had seminars like you. And we had different people from different faculties, law and other ones, coming to talk to us about methodology and getting a feel from the room or of, you know, what methods we're using, whether we would like to use some other method considering the topic. So we got feedback on the go during those seminars, which were, don't ask me about frequency, whether it was once a month or once a week for a semester, but it was at the beginning of the PhD cycle. And then we were left by ourselves to go and explore. And why I speak of guidance is because my professor had to at some point tap me on the shoulder and said, would you like to get back to law? I think you've gotten too much into economics, sociology, and psychology. Where's the law in this? So it's the guidance element, not mockery, not telling you to write on a specific topic because this is what interests your supervisor, which is frequently what is done. But it's literally the support that we have. And then my third observation is what Jukart said before. If you hadn't believed in yourself, if you hadn't said, you know, like, I'm going to pursue this because I know more than you do, then you wouldn't have ended up where you are. You wouldn't have gotten a PhD. So it has to do with your personal properties as a, you know, personality of, yes, these people are authority figures, but they don't know what I know. I have already researched the topic.
Well, I have to cut you off there because that makes me sound better than it actually was. I didn't have the confidence of I know more than you do. I didn't, because when I first applied, I hadn't done as much prior research as I could have and should have. I didn't have that confidence, but I had more of a gut feeling, which I know essentially is knowing something in your brain before you can consciously realize it, but I didn't have the confidence of, I know more than you do. I did at the later stage that I mentioned, when I already had the publication acceptance. That's for sure. Then I knew there's something there. But when I was applying, I didn't think I knew more than they did. I was just confident that this topic is relevant, because the relevance part is that what I was confident about, not my entire proposal. I knew this might be shit and I should probably come and try again. I got lucky that somebody else did worse at the interviews.
But we are talking about two things pitted against each other. One is your conviction and your pattern recognition that there's something out there. This is topical. This is important. This is going places. So this is your pattern recognition of seeing things that other people might not see yet, versus tunnel vision of, this has already been done before 15 years ago. What is there to say? And that is tunnel vision. And that is groupthink. And the mockery is also groupthink.
Oh, for sure. Pattern vision. I love that expression. It definitely is pattern vision. I also wanted to add that, because you, Anna, brought up the methodology, we all both brought up the methodology part. And I told you before, my experience was in our program that nobody knew what they were doing methodology-wise, because even the professors didn't know. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing, but I think legal studies have this specific issue. And in not just Estonia, I think all of continental Europe that has this strict approach to law as a science, whereas people outside of law might question, is this a science or is this man-made? Because I remember in the UK, which you will know better about, but I had to teach a course on comparative legal history at some point in my life. And then I learned that in the UK, law schools were trade schools first, right? Law wasn't part of academia. Universities were about the arts.
It was upskilling.
Right. Law was a trade school, which makes sense to me, because it's even today in our universities, essentially you learn a trade. It's sort of a combination, but they try to make it both. And this brings us to the classic understanding of scientific research and what is methodology. And Anna said, well, I must have struggled, especially because I had four supervisors and one of them from a common law country. I'm just going to clarify that I ended up having to drop the comparative aspect in terms of EU versus US because of the journals. Because if you do a publication-based thesis, which both of us did, right? I had five publications, I think, in total. You need three, which, to be honest, seems too little in my opinion, but that's what
it's to tick the page limits.
Yeah, I guess so. But the thing is, with publications is you are more limited in what you can do. And with my first submissions, I tried to combine comparing the US and the EU, and the publication said, well, it would be better if you drop it. So I ended up dropping that. But I didn't drop the supervisor because she still had experience. And you don't need always the specialty in a certain field to be inspired by people. So I didn't have to do that. But with the IT professor and the clinical geneticist, both of them professors in their fields which use empirical methods, and then try to explain to them as a law student without the confidence that Ilona described. I have it now. I didn't have that confidence 10 years ago. And try to explain to them, well, in law, we might not have empirical, like, I'm not doing quantitative research, not even qualitative empirical research. I'm using legal methodology, which is, you start with the basic grammatic interpretation. What do the words say? Systemic or systematic, whichever is correct, interpretation. So how does this paragraph or rule work in combination with all the rest of our legal ecosystem and so on? And try explaining that to people from other fields. And
oh, what fun.
Oh, what fun. And I remember I was in Scotland for 3 months at the end of my PhD writing this umbrella part. So I had five publications, but I need to write the
overarching
compendium
article,
or whatever called, right? Mm-hmm. That binds this together. Mm-hmm. And part of that is methodology. And our university expected like this lengthy, lengthy methodology description. Mm-hmm. And I tried to seek help from my sort of academic supervisor in Scotland, which was a professor who had written books on this topic. So it was an amazing experience. I wish I had started from there. That point, but I did it at the end. And I asked him about methodology and he's like, what do you mean? And it turns out in their thesis,
they don't explain it.
They have like a paragraph on methodology because this is legal research, which they don't try to make out to be, you know, this
statistical, quantitative, qualitative.
Right. They don't try to pretend that it is more than it is, right? Mm-hmm. If my topic is people getting information about how their genetic or genomic actually data is being used in research, I obviously have to look through all of the legal rules, any sort of explanations by the parliament. I have to look at any sort of legal literature. I have to look through all of the materials. And then I also added the comparison to the previous data protection directive. And sure, I can describe it that this is, I'm using a grammatical method. Also, obviously, I'm reading the words and trying to make sense of what they mean logically, grammatically. Obviously, I'm using systematic interpretation and so on. Okay, I have this comparative aspect, which I did call historic comparative because it was comparing the 95 directive to the 2016 GDPR. So I use all the terminology and try to then, you know, stretch it out. Mm-hmm. But it felt so fake because those Scottish theses, and this is the University of Edinburgh, which is a class, world-class university, right? This isn't a random place. I kept thinking about their short paragraphs of methodology and wishing that we could stop pretending. And I know this isn't a generalization on law because there are things, especially in like criminology or criminal law, where they do empirical stuff, right? They do research that goes more into sociology rather than specific legal research of just working with texts. But in my field, it was just such, it was like speaking an alien language with my supervisors trying to explain that, yes, my thesis is about legal texts and words and logic, you know, it's but nothing if, more.
Can I jump in? I think some of what we're critiquing here is kind of like an inheritance issue, not in the IT sense, but in the sense of there are certain ways that things have been done 100 years ago, 200 years ago, whatnot. And present day hasn't caught up with some of them yet, which means that that's the same thing about methodology. You know, 100 years ago, you were supposed to lay it out all there about, you know, how you reached. And it started with precise sciences. It started with quantitative, qualitative. It started with statistical analysis. Because just last weekend with my students, I looked through one of the reports that has been published by a research organization in Estonia. And then when you reach the point of 12 people were interviewed and there was a heavy slant towards women interviewing women. So you understand that this isn't statistically significant and all of that. So the reason why that methodology part, and I'm not defending that it should be 3 pages, but I'm saying why it's there is because people have forgotten to update. And also there's a reason why it used to be that lengthy, because it came from real sciences. And ours are sociological sciences already. But it still brings me to that one thing that I can't let go is the assumption. Why do we assume that people supervising PhD theses are masters in their field that can supervise us? I think by default, it's the exact opposite.
I would like to add here, like when I'm thinking back of my experience, the people who supported me the most, supervise-wise, were people from social sciences, like media department, who were dealing with loads of PhD candidates and were kind of young professors who knew what they were going through, and they could explain it to me, like what they were expecting from their own PhD candidates. And it was actually the IT professors. It wasn't from Tartu University, actually, it was from another university, but the IT professors who had been also supervising, I don't know, notorious IT leaders in Estonia. And they were like explaining to me what supervision is all about and how they support their PhD candidate. And
that's
how
the
they
process
always,
I'm talking about.
Exactly, protect them and try to sort of guide them through this process. And I think the article that I was writing to another journal, but published also by the University Oxford University Press with my IT supervisor, was the best experience I got from this program. Because he actually wanted to write up to his standards, and he wanted to get the best possible like article out there. But at the same time, he did not never mock me. He completely tried to sort of get the idea of this interdisciplinary thing, And knowing that I'm a lawyer, I don't think like him. I have not done research like him. I have not used methodology like him. He always sort of said it with a disclaimer that in IT, we do it like this. But, you know, this is an interdisciplinary one and it's a legal journal. So we're going to do it like somewhat a creative, flexible
That's the key word. And I think the best people who are the best supervisors, who are not even your, you know, appointed supervisors by the university, are those who are open-minded, who are creative, who are supportive, who are guiding you. And that's a little bit altruistic as well for me. I don't know, how about you, Gart?
For sure, yeah. And it takes a special kind of person to be able to supervise well. And I know I've supervised, I think, one master's thesis, if maybe two, but I'm not a good supervisor. And I know that because I'm either super interested in the topic, so I want to do it myself and write on it the way I want to write on it, or I'm not interested in a topic, in which case, you know, imagine reading pages and pages and pages of a topic you're not interested in. So I personally know I'm not, I could possibly do it if I set my mind to it. And I think that would be altruistic because it's not something I would want to do, but I would do it for the benefit of somebody else. But it's not for me. And I fully agree that the professors who might be the greatest experts in their fields, or even if they're not, either way, being a professor does not equal to being a good supervisor.
But as a last remark on supervisors, I still want to say that eventually those two associate professors that University of Tartu hired for the program, I can just say that they were amazing, at least for me. They supported. I think they didn't help Gert a lot, but for me...
Who are you talking about?
Martin Ebers and Marta.
Oh, yeah. I was basically done by the point
exactly.
They came in.
Yeah. But when they came in, I felt like a breath
Hallelujah.
Of fresh air comes through the door. Mm-hmm. And somebody finally sort of understands the topic, really wants you to graduate, really supports you, really listens what you're saying, not trying to prove a point of their own, and really got me through it. Like, although who helped me float until they came around were the IT supervisors. And then when they came, they actually helped me finish. So I'm very grateful that they're there and I'm hoping that they will remain.
No, I think they've left already. I follow them on LinkedIn. I don't think they're there anymore. But they were, one of them was a German professor who came in.
No, they're still teaching a couple of the courses to my mind.
Good for that. Good for all the students, because the one word that kept coming back to me when I fought back to our program was stagnation. And our legal department at the university in general, I kept thinking of the word stagnation. And as Ilona put it, like, things are being done the way they've always been done. And it just doesn't work anymore.
Boring.
That's one thing. And the other thing is it doesn't work anymore, because if you think back on legal research, even like 10, 20 years ago, it was a bigger thing to research something because you'd had to go to a special library, maybe even abroad, you know. Now that everything is digitalized, everything is available online. You have so much even, you know, data compilation by various apps and whatnot, programs and so on. Information is so easily accessible that it takes so much more to come up with something new. You don't need a human anymore to travel abroad and synthesize some, you know, knowledge and come back telling the other Estonians what are the Germans writing about this private law, one tiny question. Or even if you look at the thesis of our, like, former professors, some of them are like textbooks. You could never do that today. So it takes so much more to come up with something new, something useful, because everybody has the information available easily, which wasn't the case like 10 or 20 years ago. So it's much, much harder today.
But then you're supporting the hypothesis that by default, those people who are appointed as supervisors, they wouldn't know. It would be nice if they are, you know, kind and open-minded people, because that's why I appreciate my supervisor. He was a law professor and he had to sit there and listen about things that I had just found out about game theory, John Nash, all of that, and including psychological things, that I thought that were applicable in law. And he was kind and he was nice and he asked idiotic questions occasionally, but they were really good questions. And he guided me. But by default, he had no fucking clue what I was writing about. No idea.
Yeah, I guess encouragement and goodwill are the most important parts. And I can't fault my supervisors for that. Like I had they were super nice people. And that was all the experience that I shared earlier that we had with Anna in that one course. Those were other, like just professors from the department in general. Those weren't my supervisors. So,
but before we wrap this up, because we've been talking almost an hour already, I want to say that from a bystander's point of view, my experience with Gert was that she was like a rocket, you know, she just flew and we all were still on the ground and she was already on, you know, first moon and then Mars. And there was a lot of like comparison given to us every time we complained to the department saying that this is so tough and we don't know what we're doing and nobody's guiding us. They said like, but look at Gert, how is Gert doing everything? And we're like, Gert is just super. She's super. And we found this that we were kind of left to mimic your performance without knowing how exactly you did it. And I can read some words. I was actually interviewing at least one of the PhD candidates, so it's not coming only from me.
Anna is quoting.
I'm quoting.
Who are you quoting?
I'm not telling you. that Gert had this unbelievable ability to focus. It was impressive. And when she spoke, it was very convincing. And if she believes in something, she sort of stands her ground very firmly. And some of the seminar experiences were also, I remember there was a seminar and Gert expressed her opinion that was very strongly against an opinion that professor had expressed. And actually, another professor had to contain a little bit Gert and say, like, hold your horses, like try to be less sort of aggressive in expressing your opinion. Mm. That also happened.
I always like when people say that because women being assertive equals being aggressive.
And also it was characterized, Gert was characterized that acts as if she has a plan and runs towards a target or a goal, is able to analyze and very, assertive is probably the translated word. And purposeful, very full of energy, and not workaholic, but really works.
Good and, work ethic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was how we perceived you. Like being in the same program, that was how we perceived you. And you were given as an example to us, like if we weren't exactly knowing where to go, how to do this, and not really, like even in writing camps, and I attended writing camps up until COVID because I experienced COVID during my PhD program. And the writing camps also, you were sort of like out of focus. You didn't know how to do and you complained to some of the professors and they said, well, Gert is not out of focus. Like, why can't you be more like Gert?
But did you ever go and ask her how she did it?
Did I?
I have very bad memory. After I had my kid, I swear to you, I lost half my memory.
Exactly. And she had a kid and got married during the program. And then we were like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Wait a minute. I was told,
superhuman.
I was told babies only sleep and eat. So I left part of my umbrella chapter writing after my kid was born. That was the biggest lie. And I hate everybody who told me that babies eat and sleep because that was not true. She didn't eat, she didn't sleep. So that part, it was hell. I'm going to say that outright. That was not easy. That was pure hell. But to the rest of this, this is not how any of it was. I can tell you that. And the word aggressive, that surprises me, but I'm not convinced that I was actually aggressive because I've had this word used towards me once prior. I was working at the state agency of medicines where I had this job that was boring to me, which led me to PhD studies. And we had this meeting with a stakeholder. I think it was a pharmaceutical wholesaler. So it was people from the agency and then the wholesaler. We were discussing this European whatever regulation, blah, 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 and how to interpret it. And we got stuck on one point. the wholesaler thought it meant A, we thought it meant B. And so our experts and theirs kept going back and forth. And literally, I swear to you, all I said is, guys, listen, it seems like we're going in circles. We have more points to discuss. How about we just put an pause to this specific point and let's move on and just let's acknowledge that we disagree. And at the end of the day, like, the agency has the authority to interpret this, and this is just how we interpret this. And later I got feedback from my immediate boss that I had been aggressive in that meeting. I swear to you, hand on my heart, I never do this. I swear on the life of my kid, because this is true. I was genuinely, very calmly just saying, this is pointless. We have other things to discuss. And somebody perceived that as aggressive. And that was a great life lesson, because after that I was like, screw this. If anybody ever says I'm this or that, I know that it might be completely off base, because I know for a fact I wasn't aggressive, but somebody, this was one of our own experts. And I know some of them are like, maybe have this more sensitive nature, whatever.
It always says more about the person commenting and their expectations that you are not fulfilling, but then why should you? You. Than about the person actually does something. So yeah, that's alpha females are perceived as too aggressive, whereas they're just being assertive. That's fine.
Yeah, but I just learned that it doesn't mean anything. But to the other parts, when you guys thought I was hyper-focused, I have been diagnosed with ADHD a year or two back. So that might have been hyper-focused that you saw when you thought I was focused, but this is not how it works for me in real life. So I quit my job half a year after the first semester in the PhD studies. I quit my job because I decided I want to fully focus on the PhD. And I think I got some scholarship money or something keeping me afloat a bit. And I bought a new chair. I bought a monitor. I was living back with my mother back then because I was just coming back from the States, had my job at the agency, which didn't pay that well. And then I lived with my mom for a while again. I got everything set and ready. Once I had quit my job, I would just sit down and start doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What happened when I sat down?
Procrastination.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely nothing happened. I had zero ideas. I was just, I think for a week or two at least, I just like binged watched something and ate chips. That's what I did. And it, the work comes in waves. And again, I suspect this is ADHD related, but what worked for me is the publication-based thesis. I don't think I could have done this with a monograph, with the classical thing. First of all, the topic moves too fast. As I was writing my PhD, the GDPR came into force. Then you had this European Data Protection Board that is the body giving out guidelines on the GDPR, right? They gave out guidelines, and these changed within the 4 years that I did my PhD. So I couldn't have done a monograph for that reason alone. But for me personally, submitting to journals and getting any sort of feedback was sort of a dopamine hit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, this is exciting. Okay, I've got something done. I'll submit it. Will it be a yes, a no, a maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And that was super, not fun is maybe an exaggeration, but that kept me going because it was interesting. It kept it always going. You're submitting, you're getting feedback, you're doing something. So for me, the publication-based PhD was the only thing that kept me going. But it wasn't like I was always doing something. That's not, as I understand, as it works for most people with ADHD, we work in cycles.
Mm-hmm.
I might for a week do absolutely nothing and just stress about it all the time. I'm not being lazy. I'm not having fun. I'm just laying there doing apeshit nothing and just hating myself for doing nothing.
But you're thinking.
Yes, that's true. But I'm trying to teach myself to relax because my brain is still working.
I know.
And it's so... what's the right word? It's sort of
exhausting.
That's also exhausting is an accurate. Yeah, that's how it
anxiety
works.
Anxiety inducing.
That's true, but it's also so counterintuitive that to get out of the phase of not doing anything, it's called executive dysfunction, I think, in the field of ADHD, where you think about it something endlessly, but you never do anything because you're thinking so much, you're exhausted from the thinking alone. But if I would just let go, my brain is still doing the work. And if I don't stress, the brain would have more energy to do the thinking part, not the stressing part. And I would probably get back to actually doing something sooner. But you have to very mindfully, very mindfully tell yourself to let go of the anxiety, stress, guilt. Guilt is the main word that drives me there. So I think what you saw as hyper-productivity, that's not how it was from my end. From my end, it went from waves of almost depression. You feel like you're stuck, you can't go on, especially if you come out of a class where everybody tells you what you're doing is pointless, essentially.
Yeah, that's a little ray of sunshine right there.
Right. But then the journal submission system, that is what really helped me, because these are blind reviews. Mm-hmm. They don't care about this little university in this tiny, what is it, a country, Estonia, what is this? They don't even know, but they care about only
the content.
The content, if it makes sense. So that was a very good thing for me. And I think nowadays in law, I don't see a big point in writing a monograph, a book. And that was, by the way, something I was mocked for as well. And this is, again, I like all of these professors. I could sit down with all of them, have fun and drink wine, beer, whatever. But so much prejudice against anything novel. This professor of international law, very nice guy, fun guy, I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. He also gave this common sort of, well, oh, it's like a publication base. That's not a real PhD. Mm. And I kept thinking, what the hell, dude? Do you know how fast, like, sure, you're doing, like, your guy is doing maritime law. Nothing happens in 100 years in maritime law. But, like, try doing data protection law and write a monograph for years and years. Like, it'll have lost relevance, or you need to keep rewriting it every, like, 2 months. Mm. So a lot of prejudice against anything novel. Is also what
again,
I encountered.
Builds character, right?
Oh, for sure.
And you,
as long as you don't give up.
Exactly.
If you keep going, it builds character. If you give up, then then it's what.
But we made it. We made it.
Sorry. I agree. And although we all three have different paths, then this is literally the proof that you can reach the same result by taking a different path, the path that is yours. Mm. If you persevere, if you figure out what the hell is it that you want to write about, what the hell is it that you want to, you know, bring a novel thing into this world, if you figure out who can help you and who, thank God, isn't helping you, because we need to be thankful for those as well.
Yeah, you need to filter them out.
And you need to filter them out. So you need to persevere. So there is an element of personality to how we go about things. And even with ADHD, even with, you know, focusing issues, then we can still do it if it is what we want to do. If it is that we feel that the world needs this, that we are giving something back. And the different paths, they have all led us to become who we are now, with the thinking that we have now, doing the things that we are doing now.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you guys introduce your next topics, but because Anna mentioned what the next topic will be, designing your life, right? Was that the next topic? I just keep thinking about that one now, because choosing your own path is, I think, well, there's only so much choosing you'll do in a PhD program. There are certain limits and bounds, but just not getting stuck in old ways. And I think for young people out there, trying to sort of gamify any sort of process.
Oh, I like that.
Because that is what I think will be an issue for many young people. The more we have, you know, these screen time generations who have maybe a shorter attention span and the more trouble with that, just to make things exciting for yourself, whatever that means. It might mean that for every hour you work on your PhD, you get to do an hour or whatever, or like time management things. I had this 25 where method where I cannot start, but then I'll put a timer on for 20 minutes. I'll try. And then for 5 minutes, I can do whatever on my phone or something. Just
Pomodoro method.
You're right. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, I don't need the timer anymore, because you get into what you're doing. And then you can just, you know, if you have that.
Forget the world.
Right. If you have the hyper-focus issue, you might forget the world for a little while. But getting into things is so hard for so many people. And then you just force yourself with the timer. So just to figure out what works for you, and not to just listen to the people who do things as they have always been done. You know, just sit down, start reading. Sorry, sir, I cannot do that. That's not how I work. But if I put a timer, that's sort of gamifying it again. It's like, all right, just 20 minutes. Just 20 minutes, I have to do this. And that all sort of already puts sort of a spin on it.
But that is an excellent way to wrap up the session. And thank you, Gert, for leading in the next session. So whoever is listening, you have to also listen to the second part where Gerda is telling about the design of life.